like, let's just take a super extreme example of, you know, a hermit, right? The hermit, you know, once I'm going on a self understanding journey, perhaps it's religiously fueled or whatnot. But you know, the point is, I'm going to isolate myself from people. I'm literally not going to have like interactions with other human beings. On some level, though, that individual is still comporting themselves in relation to other people. Like, they can't not do that. The fact that I'm turning away from others is itself signaling that other people, like, that I have some kind of relationship with them, and I can't not be that way. And I think, for me at least, thinking about this topic, that that's the more fundamental point, that whatever myself is, whoever I am necessarily, like, at its core, is, like, or is or are my relations with others. But that doesn't have to be any like specific relationship with anyone. And I think that's part of the bigger question of today, is like, what do those like more deep specific relationships look like, but more a structural point on being like an existent person, that I'm always in relationship with, you know, Heidegger and people would term like the they. It doesn't matter what sort of, you know, stance I take.
I do want to let Tegan get to the next point here. Maybe I'll circle back to that, because I do think... Okay, all right. All I want to say is that though we exist, and in a sense have always existed in this framework of relationships with other people, and that it can seem as if everything that we've built upon other relationships with other people, I think the fact that we have the choice to turn away is actually indicative not of the fact that everything we do is necessarily relational. In a sense, yes, turning away from people is a response to people, so I understand what you're saying there, but I think the fact that we have a choice to turn away, even if it's not physically as to become a hermit, for example, but the fact that we can choose to engage with ourselves, with our own thoughts, which, you know, maybe there's not a person that's capable of parsing out every thought that is influenced by someone else and every thought that's original, like down to the core of their being. Maybe there's no one that's ever done that. But I think that the fact that we have the choice to turn away means that there is something to turn to. And I think there is a sense in which the original products of our thinking and of our own emotional responses to the world around us have their own substance that, you know, that we then bring to others too, because otherwise how would they learn from us if all we are is what they are? So I'm not sure I agree that that's impossible to do.
I think both of your comments are very interesting. I'm gonna comment on Tegan's original statement, just how in relation to other people and how that you grow from it for introspection. But I think that it's not how other people see us, but it's how we show our traits and characteristics to others. So like the effort in trying and then analyzing that either like by practically or not. So like by using like deductive reasoning or a diary or something like that. And like, that's how you can kind of introspect and work on yourself and your mind, and kind of like, that gives you kind of, as long as you have a foundation, I guess, to be able to do that introspection. But like, I feel like everyone does to a point, because I feel like we all have consciousness when like we have kind of an inner feeling of telling us something. And so I guess like, in, like that's like your core of like your thoughts and like your morals, I guess. And with more personal relationships, it gives you more opportunities to try because you're more comfortable. And then that in turn gives you more opportunities to analyze yourself so that, you know, you can see whether that conversation you're having with somebody is a reaction to what they are saying and their own personal experiences, or if it has something to do with nothing about that and it's a trigger on your own and you need to figure out why you're reacting that way. is kind of my thoughts on that, of like introspection. I don't know, I might be going off a little bit.
Just
here.
To clarify, introspection has a kind of mutual component to it necessarily, is almost what you're saying.
Could you read,
like, mutual between you and the people that you're introspecting around, so to speak? There's a relationship there, and then you, that influences, so how you learn about yourself influences how you interact with people, and vice versa.
Yeah.
No, I think that's fair. I want to take multiple steps back. Multiple steps back. Which is funny, because I don't step anywhere. My wheels only take me in places. So we're going to wheel back. We're going to circle back. We're going to go all the way back to Heidegger's description of what being or Dasein is afraid of. Being is afraid of its own existence and therefore demise. Heidegger says that being is the only phenomenon that's very existence is an issue for it. And so it is that fundamental claim of which one's being searches out meaning and purpose to try and understand how in the face of mortality they can leave a mark, a legacy, an impact. For Heidegger, that was seen as being through the channel of understanding philosophy and having a stronger understanding of that. For Socrates, it was quite similar to teach philosophy as the freeing of the mind. For Sartre, it was to realize that there was no human nature, there was only the human condition, that existence preceded any kind of essence. Meaning that the fact that you exist means your undefined possibility, and the essence that you receive is from your experience and the thing that most deeply resonates with you as an individual. And then we then move to this. We move to, once you understand who we are as individuals, who are we in relation to other people? Martin Buber, who you've heard me talk about before, in his text, I and Thou, describes I you, I it, and I thou relationships. I it relationships are commonly the relation we have with objects. So, for example, the infant and the red rubber ball. The red rubber ball to the infant is strictly an object of amusement and exploration. There's nothing in it for the red ball. The red ball is just there. The IU relationships are commonly the relationship we have with other people. It's a relationship of dwelling, of seeking, of understanding, of communicating, to then form a circle of reciprocity. And then there's the I-thou relationship, the relationship between man, as in all of humanity, and often the divine, or the thing that cannot be encountered, only thought of and spoken about. And in a sense, I think Buber would say that being closely associated to the thou, that the being cannot be completely comprehended, only philosophized upon, only thought of, never truly experienced, because that's all we are fundamentally, is being. So we don't experience ourselves, but we experience things that happen to us. And I want to talk about the statement, I love you, very quickly. I go back to this all the time because I think it is the best summation of that phrase and the most philosophically in-depth that I have ever heard. I've had Buber's thought process explained to me this way, that I love you is the call of one being waiting for a response of another person's very being. That when that response is given, it forms a circle of reciprocity. So what does that look like in practice? That looks like, what does that look like in Hugh Lafalette's terms? That looks like someone who pursues to understand who another person is for who they are and who they could be. Recognizing the holistic nature of their story and pursuing a relationship with that person. The love is the motivating factor in that pursuit. The curiosity, the undefined possibility, and then the you is the identification of the other person. And so when that happens, the circle of reciprocity is also formed. So with that, I have to do something that's a little more unorthodox than usual. I am entrusting the continuation of this conversation to my colleagues. This show was fundamentally for you to think about anyway. I want to see you put existentialism into practice, uncover the phenomenology of what this means, and build closer personal relationships through that.
I'm going to take Tegan's challenge head on and starting a kind of a new offshoot on the topic that we've been talking about today. And that is basically with regards to the idea of the self. And that is that there are two types of selves. There are selves that can, in a sense, not tolerate the company of certain people. And there are selves that make themselves kind of resilient to different types of social situations. And I think that is essentially a type of, you could say, emotional development, emotional maturity, that results from having a dynamic range of social experiences where you can be comfortable in a variety of social contexts without feeling like you're being threatened or out of place or isolated. So you have a healthy, well-developed sense of self that understands its needs and desires and is able to provide for those needs and desires kind of from its own resources rather than being solely dependent on other people. And I think that, and this is, you know, a little bit of Aaron's own original content, which means it's probably garbage, but to work off of Sartre's ideas, if we think about hell as other people, essentially that will only cease to be the case once we are at peace with ourselves from this new standpoint. So that once we've become at peace with ourselves, people no longer become a threat to us. But in the very beginning, when we lack a clear sense of self, of understanding and the ability to process our own experiences, at that point, we're kind of open to the attacks of others on our self-esteem and being. So by growing in that way, then you can become more mature and ready to deal with different types of social situations. So that's my throwing my hat into the ring into this new complex topic.
So introverts and extroverts.
I guess so in a way, but I would say that even introverts, even if they don't like social experience, they can make efforts to adjust themselves to different types of people. While they might not enjoy the conversations, they can adjust themselves a bit.
Yeah, no, I was only joking there, but I do want to bring an interesting quote into this. Now, please don't crucify me, any of you or anyone in the audience. because I'm going to bring up the probably the most controversial name in thinking in our, you know, in the 21st century, Jordan Peterson. So there's just a quote from one of his lectures on religion, I believe, that I wanted to use, which is that, which I always found interesting and I think helps me in terms of how I think about how what I know and what I'm bringing into conversation, which is that for a lot of people, he said, if you sit and think about how much of your ideas are actually your own and how much you are just parroting from other people, often when you take away everything that's not your own, you end up with this core that's maybe 10% of the knowledge that you actually bring into your everyday interactions is actually your own original ideas, which I thought was a really interesting and frightening kind of thought, because we do take a lot from other people. And, you know, there are ideas that we get from professors, from people that we look up to, that we use as our own, or that we adopt to our own perspectives and opinions because we admire those people or because we think the thoughts are valid. But rarely are those things completely original. And I wanted to bring that just to add an element to what Aaron said about, like, being steady and solid and, you know, have a complete understanding of yourself before you go out into the world with other people. And I think that's part of it, is knowing, understanding how much you really know and how much your contribution is original, which I think is interesting.
When we differentiate, you know, the sharing of ideas or find, like, some sort of specific concept or formulation that's, like, uniquely mine, I mean, obviously we're kind of, at least to me, we're delineating or drawing a kind of arbitrary line and around, like, okay, these are my thoughts here that are individual, that are unique. And yeah, to a degree, like, we obviously recognize it that way, but the immediate place that, like, my head goes when we're trying to orient this uniqueness is that, you know, I might have an idea that's recognized as being some unique in some way, but at the end of the day, my ideas have to be expressed both to myself and to others linguistically, and that in and of itself is reflective of a shared conceptual framework, right? Like, I don't, my ideas, when I speak my ideas, when I have an original thought, I don't just say gobbledygook, right? It has to be, like, comprehensible in some way. The idea has to be able to break down into concepts and structures that are implicitly shared, that are part of a larger structure that we're all, like, kind of a thinking part of.
I'd like to comment too, just a little bit on what Aaron said about, like, the two types, non-tolerant and tolerant. For me, I think it's more about, like, just, like, experience of being vulnerable than having to know yourself before a social encounter. And the only reason I can say that is because I grew up with a twin brother, so I almost have, like, the, you know, scientific experiment of, you know, heredity. And in that experience, I would say that, like, I would agree that, yeah, 10% probably could be original or authentic knowledge. I don't know the statistics or research on that. I would have to look at it. But only because, like, even with my brother and I, we were inseparable. We did everything together, but we were very different even as babies. You know, and so that's got to say something more than our thoughts are just possibly the same as the others around us, or, you know, is entangled in between. Like, I do believe that we learn from each other, but when it comes to ourselves still being authentic, I still believe that there is something that sets us apart.
And just to go back to the oldest philosopher of all time, when Socrates says, know thyself, and I guess this is pushing back a little bit against what you're saying, part of that makes the kind of assumption that you don't already know who you are. And why is that? Is it because you are essentially made up of a series of decisions and habits that you have incorporated into yourself through looking at other people's experiences? But then once you've looked at all those things, you have a choice about thinking and analyzing and determining what your own choices and what your own experiences will be next. A person's emotions are always very much their own. Emotions basically are just the ways that we connect memories to each other in positive and negative ways. And you can define it with a lot more other types of things, but I'll stop it there for now. And I think that even if that represents a very small percentage of the words that we use, that represents a vast majority of how we experience things. So even if it's not the majority of the cognitive ideas that we have, our cognitive processes, I think, are still primarily emotional. They're primarily based off of how we have seen other people process their own experiences. And that's something that's really hard to talk about because it's more non-cognitive than cognitive. It's something that kind of exists below the language sphere. Whether or not it even exists to many people is questionable.
The whole idea of knowing oneself before going into social interactions, I think, so there's a few different levels on which you can know yourself. If I may summarize a little bit from our whole discussion on existentialism throughout this series and what we've been talking about, you can know your emotions, which are your sort of reactions to situations that you're experiencing. You can know your thoughts and the ideas that you've put together based on concepts that you understand about the world. You can know the parts of yourself that are influenced by other people, so ideas you've taken or ways in which you've changed that are results of interacting with other people in your life, and you can know your relationships, and you can know what I think the existentialist would say is that you can know also the core aspects of your psyche that differentiate you as a unique individual that exists, and the parts of you that are uniquely you, so to speak. And so I think when we say that you should know yourself before you go into social interactions, I think the more you know about that core of your being, about the fundamental building blocks, let's say, of your mind and of your reactions, the thing that influences how you think and how you feel, assuming there is an underlying layer there, the better you know that, the more prepared you are to have relationships that are A, beneficial to you and to other people because you know what you want and what you need and also how you can best help others, but also the more fruitful they can be just because you're not sort of flailing in this state of I'm just bouncing off of other people around me all the time without necessarily coming back to a center, right? So I think that's what know yourself is really about, and that's what existentialism is really about. And I think that's something that I've come to by listening to all of you folks talk throughout this series and today. So
it makes me think about, you know, we talked about Jordan Peterson came up earlier. There's like his kind of famous quote, you got to like clean your room, like get yourself in order before you socially interact. There's obvious problems with that in terms of like being, you know, basically being a limiter on an individual's political and social involvement by sort of arbitrarily defined personal traits and capacities. But then there's another side, which I think is more interesting and more reflective of kind of existentialism. And like I said, Brandon, a problem that you and I have talked about before, which is, what if you're authentically a bad person, right? What if you really, like, what if you know yourself to just be kind of like a piece of crap, right? And you're like fully aware of that. Like, I am like a sociopath or a psychopath. I know I am. I'm fulfilling that. Like, I'm not pretending. I'm not going to be that kind of person. I'm not pretending to myself. I might lie to other people, but I'm not lying to me. Like, I know. And so I think sometimes when we especially with existentialism, there's this kind of implicit proselytizing that if you just like know yourself, if you figure yourself out, if you just understand, that'll imply that you'll lead this like good life. Like, that's kind of the implication behind it. And I think, and this is a discussion that's come up with many other critics of existentialism and phenomenology as well, and the sorts of movements, is like, you know, there's nothing really that bounds people to actually being like good or wholesome within these structures. You can like, you know, you could really understand yourself to be terrible, know that, and fulfill it, and still structurally, like, it works within this framework. And so then it's kind of like, well, then what is the point of this whole thing? If I can just show up and be a psychopath and do my thing, and at the end of the day be like, well, you know what? At least I'm authentic.
Yeah. So to wrap up here, Tegan left us with the very powerful idea of I love you. And I think that ties back to our previous discussion earlier on the show of what it means to have a close personal relationship and the importance of that. And that's a relationship that's not just founded on superficial things. It's not a relationship of convenience. It's a relationship based off of knowing that person specifically for who they are, not for specific things that they can do for you. Not to get too much into it, Hale, but that's the antidote to kind of those people who would instigate social interactions with perhaps not the best of motivations, is to look for people who want to know you for who you are and are willing to invest time into having positive social interactions that help both of you become better people in different ways. So we are definitely out of time for today. This has been the Canadian Philosophy Show with Tegan Marshall, Mihai Kovasser, Brandon Brownlee, Hale Rotary, Aaron Wang, and Kyra Hazen.
Kyra Tianen.
Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You can find archived recordings of the Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/thecanadianphilosophyshow and tcps.podbean.com.
Hello, I'm Justine Willis-Toms, host of New Dimensions, heard Sundays from 9 to 10 a.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM. As you know, we are living in both challenging and exciting times, prompting more people to seek new solutions and to engage life more fully. New Dimensions explores vital topics with some of the world's leading thinkers, from science and religion to politics and medicine. Join me on Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. and together we'll explore new dimensions on CJSF 90.1 FM, the station that is diverse, independent, and yours.
The Nikkei Garden Farmers Market is pleased to announce its return for the third year in a row, running from June to October. The market will take place on the second and fourth Sundays of each month from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Visitors to the market can enjoy a relaxing stroll through the locally grown produce booths, indulge in the delicious locally crafted food, and explore unique artisanal goods made by local makers, while taking in the seasonal beauty of the Japanese garden. To learn more about this event, visit center.nikkeiplace.org.
Hello to everyone.